Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the rise of woke bureaucracy, the tragedy of Julian Morne, and why hot dog ads are banned on the London Underground. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Happy Easter. Happy Easter, listeners. This is our Easter special.
Exactly. As Chris pointed out before the show, we only ever do these in person on religious holidays, as the last time was Christmas when we were together. But we're also delighted to be joined by John O'Connell, the Chief Executive of the Taxpayers Alliance. How are you doing, John?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, very well, thanks. And happy Easter to all the listeners.
Happy Easter to everyone. John, let's begin with you, because we wanted you to talk about a recent piece of research that the Taxpayers Alliance have done. A lot of people have seen stories in the media recently about how cash-strapped councils are up and down the country, how they're having to make cutbacks, how council tax is even going to rise in certain areas to plug their funding black holes and so on. But your organisation has found that they've managed to find $52 million for equality, diversity and inclusion roles. Do you want to tell us a bit about this?
Yeah, and that's only a small selection of councils. Well, maybe not a small selection, but around a third to sort of maybe 40% of councils that answered the freedom of information request that we put out. But there were 2,000 or nearly 2,000 members of staff performing equality, diversity and inclusion roles. Strangely, North Ayrshire Council came top of the list. And looking at the census data for North Ayrshire, it doesn't strike me as the most sort of diverse place in the world.
Well, that's why they need it.
Well, perhaps so, yeah.
But, and they spent like £5 million or something.
Yeah, £5 million. £5 million in a year. But you're right, the backdrop's really interesting because we've got councils going bankrupt, not just cash strapped, actually going bankrupt. And Birmingham's a particular case in point there, that equalities legislation has actually led to them being in quite big financial trouble because they've had to pay out on equal pay claims dating back several years. So, yeah, at a time when every single council, almost every single council is going to put council tax up, there seems to be a hell of a lot of councils that are not focusing on the priorities that local residents might have, like, you know, collecting the bins, making sure the streetlights work, fixing potholes and all of that kind of stuff.
No, definitely. And we should say that Birmingham Council, which is, as you said, gone bankrupt, it's not even because they were really discriminating against people in any way, shape or form. If I understand it correctly, it's that they had a bunch of kind of teaching assistants who were, and other similar roles, who didn't get a bonus, but bin men and a few other roles like that, which tend to be dominated by men, did get a bonus. And as a consequence of that, it was under the Equality Act, presented as pay discrimination and so on. So again, as you say, John, it's almost like they're gluttons for punishment. They love all this equality stuff, but at the same time, it's really hitting their bottom line. Do you think at the same time, there's a tendency to just present this as it's just Labour councils, it's just the kind of loony left, when, you know, a lot of this stems from, as we've been talking about, equalities legislation from central government? The Tories probably could have done something about some of these things. Do you think sometimes there's a tendency to let the Tories off the hook for allowing the current state of equality law, which has led to a lot of these policies?
Yeah, absolutely. The Equalities Act came into force in October 2010. So it was obviously a Labour creation. Harriet Harman, I believe, was the sort of driving force behind the Equality Act 2010. That said, that was 14 years ago, so there's been plenty of time to do something about it. And of course, what we've actually seen, to tell a better news story about some of the councils, is some of them don't hire any of these staff at all. Mm. What they've done is that they've seen the regulations that have derived from the Equalities Act as almost sort of changes in HR rules that they just wrap into everyday sort of, you know, this kind of stuff changes all the time and, you know, HR staff need to get on board with it and learn how to, enact those kinds of rules without hiring a whole team of new staff. So some councils manage to do this without, you know, sort of 50 staff, you know, 20 staff or whatever it is. That said, there's some Tory-run councils, as well as a Tory-run central government, that have had chances to change all of this in the last 14 years, and they haven't done so. So I think the colour of the rosettes now becomes slightly irrelevant on this particular issue, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Chris, any thoughts on this?
Yes, lots.
Brilliant.
Firstly, it's interesting, John says that some of these councils have not done any of this stuff and are presumably not breaching the law by not doing any of this stuff. So a lot of this is just gold plating. They're doing it because they want to do it.
Yeah.
And in that sense, the Equality Act is irrelevant. I think maybe the Equality Act actually gets blamed for a lot of things rather like health and safety legislation, which, yeah, some of it might be over the top. But in actual fact, what you're seeing is a lot of bureaucrats and officials pretending the legislation says something and actually doesn't in order to squander money on things it wants to do. How much money are we talking from these
councils, in this particular investigation, from these 100-odd councils, it was £52 million in
so you
salaries.
Can probably treble that, right? Because you've only got about a third of the councils broadly responded. Broadly speaking, we'll go with that. It's £150 million. And the defence of this kind of stuff, whenever people point out, you know, the amount of money spent on rainbow flags in the NHS and diversity coordinators and local councils, is always that, well, it's a tiny amount of money in the great scheme of things. You know, compared to the overall NHS budget, it's not very much. Well, firstly, nothing is very much in terms of the NHS budget, because the NHS budget
the GDP of whole nation.
Incredibly big, yeah. But secondly, £150 million or £52 million, if you want to lowball it, is still a lot of money that you can do things with. Now, you mentioned, John, potholes. At the moment, this entire country is riddled with potholes. You live out in the countryside. I'm sure you've seen it. It's bad where I live. It's bad everywhere I go. And, you know, the sort of upper normies and London metropolitan types always sneer at people complaining about potholes. It's considered a very provincial and gauche thing to complain about. In actual fact, aside from the countless pounds being spent trying to fix people's suspension as a result of potholes, it's a visible sign of national decline. I don't think potholes have ever been this bad in this country, at least in the age of tarmac. And £150 million would fix a lot of potholes. Potholes are not difficult to fix. It's not a tricky problem that requires a lot of thought. It's purely a matter of resources. You get people out there filling the potholes up. It's really very easy to do. You just need to dedicate money towards doing it. And as far as I'm concerned, whether it's £52 million, £150 million, or for fiver, the money spent on this rubbish would be better off spent on things like potholes. And even if it's not a massive amount of money in the general scheme of things, with a, what is it, £1.2 trillion the government's spending these days, it's a matter of priorities, and it shows you what these people's priorities are.
I think even just to build on that, if people say it's not that much money, the amount of money that councils have at their own individual discretion is quite small anyway. Mm. So the more grip and control they have over these so-called small amounts, the better, actually, because, you know, roughly, I think a lot of councils are spending somewhere north of 3/4 of their budget on adult social care. So a lot of their money is, for want of a better phrase, tied up in some quite big issues. So they have a very small amount of discretionary spending. Mm-hmm. And this is one area where they could cut back in order to, as Chris said, look at things like potholes. Birmingham, of course, are in big financial trouble. They're looking at dimming the streetlights across the city and the council area. In order to save, I think it was 900,000. Fair enough. It might be a good idea. It might not be a good idea. In the perhaps less safe place, parts of Birmingham, might not be such a good idea. But there are roles in Birmingham that are six figures for EDI responsibilities. So, you know, if you're looking for savings, that would probably jump out at me as a preferable one over to dimming the streetlights.
Could also go British summertime year round.
And we could do that.
Reduce the strain on the street lamps.
Another
benefit.
And as an example of what you're saying, John, there's if you want to be an assistant director of community services and DEI in Birmingham Council, that will earn you a cool 100k a year, which is what at least three, maybe four social care workers or something like that. I think anyone would suggest that would be a...
Jeremy Hunt, though. Apparently that's not a very big salary, Gordon, Mr. Hunt.
We're not in Surrey, apparently. Mm-hmm. No, but...
I'll take it, though.
But the point remains, right, that, you know, again, councils have a lot of statutory requirements placed on them. So a lot of their money is tied up by central government demands. They do have some discretionary spending. So the better control they have over it, you know, the more easily they could redirect it to the people's priorities.
Exactly. And what sort of things, I mean, you know, we see these stories in the newspapers about, you know, the head of diversity inclusion or the, you know, the BLM engagement officer or some kind of ridiculous array of titles. But what is it that they're actually doing? I mean, are they just attending to the supposed diversity needs of their own council workforce? I mean, it's not as if you see them, you know, roaming around the streets policing microaggressions or something. What is it that they're doing as far as...
So it's a really interesting question, and it's something that Chris mentioned earlier, that the Equality Act places no obligation on councils to hire such staff, nor penalises them for not doing so. But one thing it sort of nebulously kind of asks of public sector organizations as part of them discharging their duties is something sort of airy-fairy called the promotion of diversity. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that without harder evidence, I would imagine there's something in councils reading that part of the Equalities Act and taking it quite seriously and employing teams of people to actively promote diversity as mm-hmm. opposed to just, strip back and focus on the parts of the Equalities Act that require, no discrimination in pay, no discrimination in promotions and these kinds mm-hmm. of things, which are, again, the much more basic HR functions that could be wrapped into what council's already doing.
And what can people do if they're upset about this? Do you reckon this is something that people can take the fight to their own councils, to writing letters and things like that? Or do you think it's just so ingrained now that it's not really going to make too much difference?
I think every little piece of activism possible is a good thing. So writing to councillors, writing to MPs is always a good thing. But you touched on it earlier. There's a big sort of central government issue here as well. So I know Kemi Badenoch talked a lot about how the Equalities Act, while it's not great, isn't necessarily the big evil that people think it is if it's applied in the right way. But if that was maybe taken more seriously by central government, then councils could follow suit and save us all a bunch of money.
And it does seem like it's only going to get worse, because I take your point, Chris, that they are gold plating what might be required of them underneath the Equality Act. They're reading a lot into some quite broad and kind of sweeping duties that it places on them. But at the same time, each new piece of legislation or each new kind of government scheme surely kind of gives them more incentive. There was the kind of mandatory pay gap reporting in 2017. Labour now want to do that for race as well as to bring in a whole new Race Equality Act. So surely the more of those kind of layers get added, the worse it gets at the very least.
Yeah, the more legislation, the worse. Repeal it all.
Get rid of the Equality Act. Another one of the beats of this podcast, it feels like.
Yeah, it is. It does feel like a bit of a panacea. Building more houses and getting rid of the Equality Act in 2010. Things would be very different now. Who knows? We never will know, and we're certainly not going to find out.
So the answers are quite simple, really.
Well, I like to think so, John. Yeah. I like to think so.
Yeah. On that positive note, should we talk about Jolyon Maugham?
Oh, yes, please.
So Jolyon Maugham, friend of the show.
Yeah, big friend. Friend of the IA.
Leader of the Good Law
Project. Friend of Tufton Street.
Exactly.
Me and John obviously share a desk at Tufton Street in our office.
He's often outside, I'm sure, kind of waving a fist at you menacingly. But his organisation, the Good Law Project, has been pretty prolific in recent years in terms of going after various different organisations, going after the government on various different issues, infamously failing more than it succeeds, to put it gently. But Chris, you wrote this week, or recently I should say, about its latest target, which is Gamble Aware. Jolyon Maugham is getting into the whole gambling issue. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's been going on?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny target for Jolyon, because normally he goes for the sort of low-hanging fruit, which is to say the kind of organisations that the bottom-feeding FBP-type people who will give him money don't like. And so he goes after the IA, he's going after GB News this week. And Gamble Aware is not really a big... not really got a big target on his back as far as the midwits are concerned. So why is he going after them? Well, Gamble Aware, to explain, is a charity set up basically by the government. I mean, it's set up, I think, by the gambling industry, certainly funded by the gambling industry, but I think the government more or less told them under Blair to set it up. Very similar, actually, to Drink Aware, mm-hmm. which the government also basically told the alcohol industry to set up and fund. And they have a similar mission, which is to educate the public and to provide, help and support and what have you. But the Gamble Aware actually goes a bit further, because it also pays for the National Gambling Helpline, which gets thousands of calls a year. Nobody has really complained about the helpline, I don't think. I think it seems to work quite well. And Gamble Aware's educational stuff seems to be fine as well. I don't have any feelings at all either way about Gamble Aware or Drink Aware. If anything, I think they're a bit too nanny state, actually. But there's this new sort of generation of anti-gambling activists who are taking a what can only be described as a public health view of gambling, which, if you know what the public health view of smoking and drinking and ultra-processed food is not good news for gamblers. So they take the view that essentially anything funded by industry is highly suspect. There's no such thing as free will or personal responsibility, and the government should regulate gambling like tobacco. That is, in a nutshell, what they believe. And so they're going after Gambleware because Gambleware, A, is funded by the industry, and B, does more or less push personal responsibility, which, you know, if you're helping individuals who've got a problem, you know, a problem with gambling, you do need to at some point say, this is down to you to change. Yeah, that's just a fact of rehabilitation. But there's another dynamic to it, which is that there's a windfall tax, effectively, a gambling levy about to be put on the gambling industry, which is going to rake in between 50 and 100 million pounds a year, vast amount of money, which is supposed to be spent on research and education and rehab or treatment. And even if a very small proportion of that goes towards research, that's a huge amount of money for academics.
Yeah.
Right. It's a huge slush fund for academics. So all the public health academics who previously just been ranting on about tobacco and vaping and ultra processed food and booze and so on, they're now making a beeline for this massive slush fund. And I think they are trying to knock Gambleware out of the picture, because once the tax comes in, the gambling industry won't be funding anything like Gambleware anymore. Because it's been taken off them by force. It'll come down to the decision made in Whitehall about who gets this kind of money. Gambleware, as the incumbent, as the organization that currently provides things like the National Gambling Helpline, they, you would think, are favorites to get some of that treatment money. But there are other organizations set up in a very recent past. It's amazing. If you look at my piece in The Critic, it's amazing how many NGOs and charities in the gambling space have suddenly popped up just in the last 2 or 3 years. I think some of these are going to be fishing around for that money, and they want to knock Gambleware out of the picture. And I don't think that Julian Maughan is probably aware of this dynamic at all. I think he's just a useful idiot. But it's interesting that this complaint he's making to the Charity Commission about Gambleware, he's doing it alongside the guy who runs an organization for Gambling with Lives, which is another gambling organization, anti-gambling organization, that's popped up in the last few years. And I think he's getting involved in what is essentially a battle over funding. I suspect that's what's going on. And I also suspect, of course, because it's Julian Maughan, that he won't get anywhere with it.
No, absolutely. John, what have you made?
Yeah, I find it really interesting, as Chris mentioned, that some new groups have popped up in the last few years. Of course, the gambling levy was, Chris, was it 2020? Was first proposed by a committee in the House of Lords?
For 2020, possibly. It was the early idea. Yeah.
So, you know,
the white paper was 2020.
Well, yeah. And you can see Chris's point that once this money becomes available, then it's taxpayer-funded lobbying, isn't it? It's taxpayer-funded lobbying and political campaigning writ large. It's just organisations seeking more taxpayers' money and then using that to lobby for even more taxpayers' money. And we see it across all different sectors. And this just seems to be, you know, version 2.0 of it. So that's where I would worry from a TPA perspective, that there's going to be lots more money being kicked around, taxpayers' money kicked around. Will the Tories win the next election? Probably not. But, like, you know,
it won't make any difference.
I think that was going to be my point, that, you know, whether they stayed in or not, I don't think that, you know, these forces, nobody seems willing to stand up to them in central government at all, again, regardless of the rosette. So it probably doesn't make a difference who's in power.
And going back to the local councils, you know, if you go look at Manchester Greater Authority, as it's called, I think, they've got in bed quite explicitly, not literally, but quite explicitly with Gambling with Lives, which is a pretty hardline anti-gambling group. And you go on the website that has been set up with taxpayers' money in Manchester for problem gambling, the whole website is just anti-gambling, right? Normally it would be, you're having a problem gambling, here's how you can get help. This is just, a gambling is everywhere, it's been advertised too much, we need to do something about it, the government should have, blah, 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 blah. And if you then go to the bit where it says, you know, do you need help? It's got the National Problem Gambling Helpline on the website, but when you click on that page, it says, this is funded by the gambling industry. So you've got this sort of, essentially a health warning, essentially something telling you not to contact these people, with the implication that if you ring them up, they're going to tell you to keep gambling or something, right?
Give you a couple of free spins.
Because, you know, there are people who need to get help for their gambling. And they're being essentially told, don't use that path. Don't ring these people up. It's incredible what's going on there. This is what happens when you let activists take over essentially public services.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people were aware of this, you'd just think it would end overnight. I struggle to think there'd be like one voter not involved in this debate who thinks it's a good idea for taxpayers' money to fund lobbying organisations whose job it is to lobby the state to change the laws in line with what it is that they think is correct. It's crazy. But Chris, you mentioned earlier Morm's war on the IEA.
Yeah.
Which would be remiss if we didn't talk about. Do you want to explain to the people what he was coming after your organisation for and how it ended up?
So going back to what I was saying about low-hanging fruit, obviously the IEA is very unpopular with a certain class of people on.
You've destroyed the country, haven't you?
Yeah, because we're pro-hard Brexit and blah, 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 supposedly. So he went after us. He's not going after... I've noticed he stopped going after people with litigation, which used to be his USP, right? He's a blooming King's Counsel. He used to sue people and usually lose, but now he's just writing indignant letters to people. I don't really understand why that requires a crowdfunder, just writing a letter of complaint. Anyway, he said he's going to go after Tufton Street, which these idiots think includes Rodnor Street, and basically just wrote a letter to the Charity Commission saying, I don't like what the IEA says, therefore it shouldn't be a charity. Lots of people have done this in the past. I mean, God knows how many green ink letters the Charity Commission's had in the last decade from people who believe the sort of George Monbiot view of think tanks and Tufton Street and the IEA. But as a result of all these letters, the Charity Commission is very well acquainted with the IEA. It knows exactly what we do, which is not what Monbiot thinks we do, and has dismissed all these complaints. So Morn on this occasion has got together with a serial sort of vexatious complainer of the IEA, a guy called Andrew Perkis, who used to work for some big state-funded charity. He doesn't like us because he thinks that we should just say things that are socialist all the time. And there was nothing new in the complaint at all. It was just the usual stuff this guy's been banging on about for years. So the Charity Commission very quickly said, thanks for your letter, Julian, but no dice. And then Morm complained. Not only did they do that, they actually repealed is a word? I don't know. Cancelled a sort of caution that they'd given the IEA years and years ago around the Brexit time. And they actually just said this no longer stands. So in a way, Julian has deregulated the third sector. So he's done a great job with his reverse Midas touch. So that's been thrown out. And on the day that it was thrown out, he then launched a campaign against GB News.
Mm.
He really is fishing for...
the chairman of the Charity Commission wrote an article in the Times as well, explicitly saying that the think tank sector deserves to retain its charitable status and, you know, regardless of place on the spectrum.
I think that was the day before Julian made his complaint, so it was all quite badly timed.
Yeah. Is it all sort of driven by this... It's sad to even contemplate this, but driven by that Twitter narrative that the regulators are all secret Tories and all this kind of stuff.
Mm. Well, that's his narrative now that his complaint's been thrown out. He said that the Charity Commission is a weapon, not a regulator.
But then even moving on to GB News.
Borderline libelous, I would have thought.
But then moving on to GB News, presumably to have a pop at Ofcom.
I just think he's just... he's giving the public what they want. You know, he's got his audience, doesn't he?
Doesn't need to make sense. The idea that loads of libertarians...
He's made $76,000, I think, last time I checked on his crowdfunder for his anti-Tufton Street campaign. I don't know how much he's got for his anti-GM. Yeah. This stuff all adds up. Where the money goes, I've no idea.
It doesn't make any sense. What, like, libertarians are going to be naturally attracted to working all kinds of regulators? Or is it that there's actually a plot to take them over launched by yourself? I mean, it doesn't stand up to any scrutiny, but I guess he's just trying to ride out that remain of Twitter anger with yourself.
Never give a sucker an even break. These people have been throwing money at him for best part of 10 years. They gave about £1 million to Carol Cadwallader.
Yeah.
You know, if it's out there, why not, you know, make hay while the sun shines.
And John, as another representative of the Tufton Street Nexus, what do you make, as James O'Brien famously once called it, what do you make of all the conspiracy theories that swirl around your various organisations? I mean, we occasionally come up as one sort of node in the spider diagram, but we're slightly more on the outside of it, unfortunately. But this idea that if you look at Britain over the course of the past 10, 15 years, that it's quite clear that kind of clear-cut, unvarnished, tax-cutting, yeah. libertarian philosophy has obviously it's taken obvious. Over the state.
All you have to do is look around you.
Yeah. where does this come from, this obsession with the IEA tax-based alliance?
From our perspective, state spending gone up massively, tax burdens at a 70-year high. We're not doing that well, are we? Also, the slightly more mundane thing of, you know, if anybody came into our lovely little office block in Westminster, we've got a team of, 11 people at the moment, probably 11, 12. It's a very quiet sort of normal office, really. It's just the caricature of it is hilarious to the people that actually, you know, work at the TPA and work in the you know, broader SW1 area. Absolutely hilarious.
Because it must be like a TARDIS if it's going to include all these think tanks. Mm. In practice, you walk through the door, there's enormous TARDIS-like space in which there's 50 think tanks. Mm-hmm. and Spike, probably. Yeah, you know, all there, just crammed, shoulder to shoulder, plotting the downfall.
Eat there, sleep there.
Well, I think about, like, you know, when you have a spider diagram, you're
something's gone wrong.
Yeah, something's gone wrong. You're probably admitting that you're not really based on concrete evidence.
Absolutely. Should we talk about Ed Gamble, stand-up comedian, who the reason we're talking about him is because of the fact that he had one of his adverts for his upcoming stand-up tour rejected by the London Underground on the basis that it broke their junk food advertising ban. So the show, I think, was called Hot Diggity Dog or something of that description. And so it was a picture of him eating a hot dog, some ketchup and some mustard around his face. Mm. As a consequence of the complaints, he had to replace the hot dog with a cucumber. Chris, this won't be a surprise to you because you've written extensively about this ad ban. Came in 2019. Mm. I believe anything that's high in fat, salt and sugar isn't allowed to be depicted. And whilst I think many people would assume that would be limited to McDonald's not advertising or what have you, it applies to absolutely everything. So I'm sure you weren't surprised by this, but what did you make of this particular?
It's a gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? Is Sadiq Khan's so-called junk food advertising ban. Because companies that are not advertising food at all, for a start, keep getting caught up in it. So we had the wedding cake affair. Do you remember that? We discussed that on the
West
podcast.
End play. Was
West
it?
End play that showed a wedding cake because the play was about a marriage. And then there was TFL's own adverts had to be changed at great expense because they showed things like strawberries and cream at Wimbledon and curries in Brick Lane and things like this. It keeps happening again and again. And this one, I'd never heard of Ed Gamble, and I think this has been the best thing for his career probably because he's given his show an incredible amount of publicity. I initially sympathised with him. I've since gone off the guy, I have to say, despite not knowing anything about him and never seeing him before.
Been on a real roller coaster.
Well, yeah, it's been up and down with Ed, me and Ed, because he came out speaking to the BBC, said he agrees with the laws, he agrees with the policy, he thinks it's very sensible. And then he said that he was only eating a hot dog because he was hungry on the day of the photo shoot. Well, that can't be right, can it? No. When your show is called Hot Dippity Dog or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, so why is he lying about that? Why don't they say he was...
like he's been caught out and he has to make some sort of...
Yeah, excuses. I really wanted to eat a cucumber. Mm. So he's not the first person to do this. Farm Drop were the very first company ever to get caught up in the TFL food advertising problem. And they were a very woke kind of ethical, will drop organic food to your door if you live in London company. And they came out immediately afterwards going like, we totally agree with the regulation here. It's very sensible. We don't want people eating fat and sugar and salt. We just don't think it should include jam and butter and stuff that we sell. Just say these laws are stupid. I've been caught up in it and it shows how stupid these laws are. There's nothing wrong with Ed Gamble having a hot dog. There's nothing wrong with a hot dog company showing a hot dog on the tube. Get a grip, everybody. These people have got a good opportunity to say, I didn't know anything about these laws until I tried to advertise my stand-up comedy show. But now I do. I think they're bloody ridiculous.
Yeah, I think
so. Screw Ed Gamble. It's lucky he hasn't been done for advertising gambling.
I think you're right. I'm disappointed that he was so sort of craven in his response. But look, Farm Drop are actually trying to sell food, right? Ed Gamble wasn't sort of saying buy one hot dog, get six free children. You know, it was very much just a sort of a play on
words.
Come
along to my pro-regulation stand-up show.
But there wasn't even an attempt to sell food. It ought to have been the sort of archetypal case of this being totally mental,
yeah,
totally absurd. But now it's turned into, oh, actually, you know, these are really good regulations.
So that's why it's a great story, is because it demonstrates how ridiculous the whole idea is. Because in a sense, there's a logic to extending the advertising ban to products, to companies which aren't even advertising food products. Because if you genuinely think, as these people seem to do, that people are so stupid and dense and suggestible, that just the sight of a burger on the London Underground will flick a switch and then they'll instantly go and buy one, and therefore it's within your rights to remove that image, then why wouldn't it apply to a picture of a wedding cake for a West End play or a picture of a hot dog for a comedy show?
It's a slippery slope.
But it's obviously ridiculous, and sometimes it takes cases like this to demonstrate that. But the fact that no one seems to be twigging, even the person being censored.
He could then make a name for himself as being, I'm the anti-over-regulation guy. I'm the guy who, I got caught up in this. He could dine out on this for years. Go, and I got screwed by the TFL ad ban. And now I've realised how bad things are in this country. Could become a great libertarian, pro-hot dog comedian. But instead...
That gap has been yawning for many years. So,
I eat a cucumber instead. So I'm not going to see his show, despite all the publicity.
There you go.
But a lot of people will. It's probably sold out now.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's the absolute gift to him, I'm sure.
Can we, while we're talking about local councils... We were talking about local councils, and we're now talking about advertising.
Yeah.
Can I mention the bringing all these things together, like a weaver? The Sheffield Council banning adverts for nearly everything. Do you see this?
No, I didn't. Tell me more.
So there's a guy speaking, John, as you were before, about useless, overpaid council busybodies. There's a public health director in Sheffield called Greg Fell, who is now also the president of the Association of Public Health Directors, and he has managed to force through, with the help of an organization called Ad Free Cities, a ban on billboard advertising in Sheffield on billboards that are owned by the council. So it's quite a limited ban, to be fair, but not limited in scope, because it doesn't just include things that are already banned, like tobacco, which it does anyway, even though it's a bit superfluous, but it includes vaping products, unless they're in like a government pro-vaping campaign. That makes a lot of sense. Aeroplanes, airports, cars, including hybrid vehicles. I forget the entire list, but it's quite extensive. Guns is there for some reason.
Because you used to not be able to walk through a shop.
No, I know.
Constantly being bombarded by Smith
and Wesson trying to sell you a handgun. Loads of products that either are not advertised, but lots of products that are advertised and no longer will be on council-owned billboards in Sheffield. And this is, again, isn't it, the slippery slope.
Is this more onerous than TFLs then?
Yeah, way more. It includes all the fast food, all the high-fat, sugar-salt food, plus things like aeroplanes. And cars. And numerous other things that I've already forgotten, but I've written about if you want to look it up. That was reported by the BBC fairly uncritically as well. I guess Ed Gamble can advertise in Sheffield as long as he keeps with a cucumber motif, I suppose.
There you go. Should we reach into the postbag?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So let's try and squeeze in one. We've got a question here from John Bryan.
Friend of the show. Actual friend of the show.
And I want to bring this up because it relates back to our conversation about Jolyon Morham. John wants to know, going on previous form alone, the odds of Jolyon Morham winning are very slim. So how has he managed to get people to back him with some money? Just to add a bit of context to that, someone did a bit of sort of research a few years ago into how successful the Good Law Project had actually been. And surprise, surprise, it wasn't very successful at all. So this was back in 2022. They found that in terms of all of the legal fights it had initiated up until that point, it was 44. They had only won 8, which sounds quite high, actually, in terms of what
more than I would have expected.
But they had actually managed to fundraise by that point over £4 million in order to have all of those losses. So, John, how about you first? Why do you think people keep giving money to these no-hoper campaigns to... strip Chris of his knighthood or whatever it might be,
Long overdue knighthood. Yeah.
Truss was going to give that in a second term, I think. wasn't to be.
It clearly is just a sort of status game, isn't it? It's social media driven. I think somebody mentioned it earlier, the sort of dying embers of the FBPE kind of mindset. And it's just an outlet for that kind of general worldview, I suppose. And the idea that this kind of activism is going to change the world. I don't know. It just seems to be sort of derived from status signals.
Yeah.
For me, the lack of results are kind of irrelevant.
Chris, do you have any theories as to why people keep handing over their cash to Jolyon, even though he's got a less than brilliant success record?
Well, I just assume they're thick. I mean, it's not even about status, is it? Because these donations are anonymous, I think, most of the time. These dark money donors, they just got more money than sense. You know, there's a whole untold thousands and thousands of people on Twitter who are incredibly stupid, probably don't work. I think they've got a lot of time on their hands to be on Twitter. Probably got long COVID. And they've got money to give to anyone who turns up. There's a whole world of grifters out there who are getting 10 or 20 quid off people, and it all adds up. You see the number of retweets his tweets get when he's talking about something like the IEA or GB News or anything like this, you know. Fair play to him. You know, to be quite honest, Jolyon, if you're listening, I think you are one of the colourful figures in public life who make life better. I genuinely believe that. He cracks me up all the time, Jolyon Moore. Every Friday afternoon, Guido puts out some tweet about how he's just lost his latest court case. It's always on a Friday afternoon for some reason. And it cheers me up for the weekend.
Yeah.
So long may it continue. He's only taking money off people who don't really deserve to have any. So no harm is really being done. He wastes a bit of time because, you know, every time he sues somebody, the recipient has to spend some money dealing with it. And every time he writes a stupid letter to the charity commission, they waste a bit of time. But I think he's a net good. He's a good lad. And he cheers me up.
Definitely. He looks like a cartoon character. He lives in a windmill, famously.
There's a few people like that on Twitter.
Bludgeon that fox to death. I mean, it's...
Yeah, exactly. The fox thing was incredible. There's a few people
English eccentric.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have a problem with him per se. But just, you know, don't sue me.
Fair enough. We're almost at the end of the show, but John, we have taken to asking our guests, because this is a very libertarian show and we're against bans in almost all circumstances.
Except if it involves luggage.
Exactly. So if you had to have one ban, what would it be? So just to give you some examples, while you think, Chris's famous one is wheelie suitcases because he has a visceral hatred of
backpacks.
Seeing them, we had people banning football commentary, British football commentary in particular.
I'm
trying to think of some other examples. VAR has come up from time to time, as you would
imagine. It's all luggage and football.
So if you can't have wheelie suitcases or backpacks, well, what's the in between?
Just carry an old-fashioned 1950s suitcase
on your head,
with enough for a few shirts.
All right.
And some socks, and that's your lot.
Right. Yeah. What is my petty ban?
Yeah.
Probably abbreviating the names of foods on menus. I'd call it the Slaw Act 2024. It's not slaw, it's coleslaw. And I would ban any sort of abbreviation of food names on menus. Yeah.
I like that. Ooh. It's both specific but also very annoying when you see it.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
I like it.
Excellent.
I think there's some exceptions later.
Exceptions as in the...
Well, ones that we've come to accept.
Ones that you will say, actually, that's all right. I can't think of any now. I can't think of any other abbreviations of food apart from... Can you?
Well...
You must be able to.
Maybe a more acceptable one might be sausage and mash. Mash is an abbreviation.
Yeah, mash.
Potato.
Yeah, there we go.
Is it Americanized abbreviation?
Maybe it's Americanized. Yeah. I'd have to do some work on the actual technicalities of it, and maybe Chris could throw in some amendments to the legislation at some point. But
say slaw. Just be more specific. You say the thing you want to ban is people calling coleslaw slaw.
Yeah.
Oh, then that's iron tight.
Yeah.
That's ironclad. Yeah. No problem.
Yeah. On that pedantic note, Chris, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Happy Easter.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.